everybody. This is Dave Garamella, and I am your philanthropist. And today I'm honored. I have two amazing philanthropy professionals and friends. Dan and Nancy are just incredible thought leaders in the philanthropy space. So I just, if you don't mind, everyone, I want to take a few minutes just to kind of give their backgrounds. It's really impressive, and I think it's going to lead to an absolutely wonderful conversation. So first off, I have Nancy Bassani, who is the System Vice President for Philanthropy, Strategy, and Governance for Common Spirit Health, which is headquartered in Chicago. Nancy serves as the System VP, and it's one of the largest not-for-profit healthcare systems in the United States. They have close to 82 or 83 fundraising entities across 21 states. And in her role, she facilitates governance. She is about education and professional development and just really supporting that local effort regarding strategic planning. So really, really excited to kind of get her take on what's happening right now in philanthropy among the COVID crisis, but also to kind of hear some of her stories of her 25, 30 years of experience. So Nancy, welcome. And then on the other end, we have Dan Murphy, who is currently the CPO for Dignity Health Foundation's Inland Empire and Glendale Health Foundation. He is in the trenches. He is a frontline chief development officer, major gift officer extraordinaire, and just has some really, really great stories to share with us. And hopefully the two of them have come to me with an amazing problem that we're going to try to solve today on the philanthropist. So with that, I am going to just kind of throw this out there. And the two of you could wrangle or fight over who's going to answer first. But what do you think are some of the biggest challenges we're facing now in the industry? Dan. Go ahead. I'll just wait.
Well, you know, I think for me, the biggest challenge is, I'm sure you've heard it before, is the situation we're in with COVID and having the ability to develop particularly brand new relationships in the Zoom world that we're living in. Zoom has been so beneficial in so many ways. However, you know, beginning brand new relationships, which is such a big part of fundraising, major gift fundraising, it's not impossible. And I've heard you even talk about how, you know, you just need to do it and sort of break that ice and keep going. But it definitely is a challenge. I think it's a lot easier with those relationships that have already been established to some degree. And they say, hey, let's reconnect on Zoom. And everyone's getting used to it, even with their families. But to do it from the get-go, I think that's a challenge. I think the other big challenge, and I don't want to talk on and on about it because I think is really the topic today, is continuing to say, how do we make that monumental shift of focusing on major and planned gifts and get away from some of the other fundraising that has tend to be our historical way of trying to raise money. So,
and not to... not to minimize COVID, but that's been the best outcome of this. It's made us kind of reevaluate what works, and that major and that plan giving philosophy is what moves things forward. I'm really kind of anxious to hear though from your volunteer leadership and engaging board members in that process to promote, whether it's a system or promote your hospitals that you're the chief philanthropy officer for, would be really, I think, helpful for me to see, you know, how you've struggled and how you've succeeded in dealing with that board piece.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I'd like Nancy to talk about that first question from a more of a global perspective too.
And I think Dan and I had, you know, many opportunities to really focus on what this means to our boards, for his particularly, but throughout the entire system. And if there was a silver lining to the pandemic, I think it was the reflection of the generosity we saw and the willingness for people to raise their hand and say, how can I help? And that I think was heartfelt for so many people to want to contribute. We really saw that in our board directors who, instead of taking this opportunity to disengage, which I think was a fear at least that I had, that we would have these 2,500 board directors throughout the nation that would hit pause and would say, oh, well, when this is over, we'll come back and do our work. And so we spent a lot of time trying to think of strategies to work with the boards to not do that, to be able to say, how do we actually accelerate our work together, whether it's through Zoom or whether it's through a host of other kind of creative ways that we could connect our networks and engage despite the pandemic. And I think I was really pleased to see so many examples throughout all of Common Spirit where people leaned into that idea.
Did you have to prompt them to become more involved or stay involved in the, was there an embarrassment? Oh, I should stop because this is more of a medical situation than anything else?
Well, I'll give you kind of my two cents, and then I think Dan probably can give you the perspective a little bit closer to the actual board directors. I felt like everyone knew that this was an international crisis, and so they wanted to help. I do think we had to provide some strategies that would say the how, because everyone got the why. Everybody knew okay. they wanted to support, but the how is a little bit harder. So how do we make this a reality? And so not to have every single one of our 82 foundations recreate the wheel around that, to come up with some recommendations and some suggestions that all of them could think through to implement. We've had some really good ones that I know Dan has good experience with in helping them to think through, well, who now in their world are those relationships given COVID and given the needs okay. of the hospital they need to reach out and connect to. So that we don't pause and just stop until it's over.
I appreciate that. Dan, did you want to kind of follow up on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm thinking more about, you know, kind of how we want to jump into the therapy that we need related to our problem. But, you know, it's funny just listening to this conversation. You know, Nancy and I obviously work in healthcare philanthropy, and I don't know why, I guess my mind was wandering a bit, and I was thinking about what it must be like to be a chief philanthropy officer, or even more interesting, a board member for a nonprofit that is not healthcare, that is like a symphony or a museum, and what they must be going through. And just hearing Nancy talk about how our board members and our volunteers and our donors have really stepped up across the system, I'm sorry to derail a little bit, but I just had that thought of like, my goodness, I wonder what stories are out there, because they're literally talking about survival. At least our board members, kind of as Nancy alluded to, obviously are like intimately interested in the topic for multiple reasons. But they also know that what they have always supported are the frontline caregivers and institutions right. that are there for us, whether it's a pandemic or a fire or an earthquake or what have you, or a heart attack, or, you know, on and on and on. So just an interesting thought that hit me. And I think we'll dive into that. I don't want to jump ahead, David, but as we talk about this, having our boards think more about relationships and how that relates to the need to move forward with major gift fundraising. So before I blab on and on, maybe I'll allow you to ask a couple questions.
No, I appreciate the comment about the relationship piece. And I guess then to Nancy, all foundations are not functioning at the same level. And I don't mean from a success perspective from fundraising, but board members that are engaged, clinical staff that partner with the foundation. Is this the type of situation where you would like to see kind of engagement rolled out in a system way that everybody kind of buys into it?
Absolutely. And you're really right about that, David, in the sense that there's such a continuum of some of our boards that still operate under a fairly older kind of traditional model that they see themselves as really doing more operational activities and issues related to finance and legal, instead of really moving to the opposite direction of fundraising.
Sure.
All of our philanthropic boards are fundraising boards, but how closely they've adopted that varies tremendously. So our goal from a system perspective is to help provide the tools that let all of those boards see the big picture of why that matters, how they can help them move in that direction. One of the things that you were just saying, Dan, when you're talking about in some unusual ways, we are fortunate by the topic for which we raise funds and the relevance of it. Because as I look at our board directors, I see so many who aren't quite sure how to help. They want to help, they're on our boards. And one statistic that always struck me was from the National Center for Charitable Statistics that said 70% of boards at any given time are recruiting for new directors. So it struck me that if we don't make that experience a meaningful one for a board director, if we don't help them understand how they make a difference, why there's impact in their work, boy, there are just other foundations, other nonprofits lined up to take the best and the brightest from us. And so I think that's an important thing for us as chief philanthropy officers to understand that we have a responsibility to make the board experience a really, really meaningful one to our directors if we want to keep them engaged with us.
I also want to challenge you though to, yes, that is what we want. I sense through working with my own clients and just kind of what I see that we have a tendency, especially if from the fundraising side, we're not as transparent as we should be when we bring these board members on. And, oh, we want you to be just a great ambassador in the community, or, oh, we thank you. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, we need their help because our mission is so, so important. And philanthropy is so crucial to success now and survival, whether you are that small social service agency or a healthcare system.
Yeah, I think we've made progress in that area, but I do agree there's still a bit of that bait and switch area where we just want them and we want to bring them on. And so we downplay what we need from them. We downplay the time commitment. Then we get them on board. Now, the only thing I will push back a little on that is there was some work done a couple of years ago by BoardSource that looked at, they asked boards to rate what they think is the most important things that they do. And then they asked them to rate how well they do them. And I was really surprised that 67, two-thirds absolutely get that fundraising and being an ambassador in the community, that those are the most important things to do. So it isn't that we haven't kind of walked through the roles and responsibility. Then you ask them to rate how good they are at it. And that's where they give
us that's what it's lowest. Right. Yeah.
So to me, it comes back to, and I know Dan and I have talked about this a lot, and he's put it into action. It's helping them understand how to do it. Not necessarily theoretically getting that they should do it, but helping them to understand how they do it. And Dan has some great stories about that process that he's gone through with his boards.
Yeah, it was funny, while you were talking earlier, I wrote down, I hope Nancy mentions that study, and you just did. And I found that to be so fascinating. That sort of kicked off the AHP session that we did this year. And I kind of joked, this didn't make it to the conference, but I think they graded themselves a C- as fundraisers. And I said, yeah, that's grading yourself. That's like when you were in school and you graded your own paper, of course they bumped that up. So their real grade was probably like a D-. so I think that that's a huge, huge note. And David, you mentioned that concept of bait and switch or getting a board member on. And one of the things that we changed is we utilized our revised statement of commitment, which is a very simple one-page document that we give our board members now at the beginning of their term, and they sign it, and their executive committee or the governance committee, whichever that board might have, utilizes that statement of commitment almost as a way to grade how the board member did in living up to the statement of commitment. With all that being said, the one thing I'll say about this one-page, very simple document is the very first thing on that document says, fundraising is the principal role of being a member of this board. That's the Beautiful. Very first thing they're Beautiful. Greeted with. And then it gets into other things about giving and about having a major gift prospect, which is a very big topic. Mm-hmm. All that being said, the reason why I mentioned that is that now when our board has a new, you know, maybe they use their diversity skills matrix and they find a new board member that somebody recommends and says, oh, they fit this, they fit that. So on all paper, they look like a great prospect. So sure enough, just like olden days, we go have lunch with them or a Zoom meeting or whatever now. But the difference being is that I pull out that statement of commitment. And I said, you know, obviously we're not here today for you to sign this, but what I'd like to do is walk through the statement of commitment so that you understand this will be presented to you if and when you are on the board, so that you completely understand what this board is all about. And so by walking through it today as a prospect for joining the board, you have time to now go home and really think about the role, because you're hearing exactly what this is about. And that was a huge shift, because we would run into exactly what you talked about in the past where, and when we got buy-in from the board, because I think oftentimes you have a board member say, oh, you know, Mary Smith, she's perfect. She'd be great for the board. I'll join you for the lunch and we'll go to lunch with them and it'll be great. And by doing that, it takes out that uncomfortableness where Mary might actually be going, oh, that's not what I thought this board. I thought this was the hospital board where we talked about patient safety and this and that. And no. This is the fundraising board, of which our mission is healthcare. So I just wanted to mention that we do that.
No, that's a great, great tip. And David, yes.
You know, it's interesting about though the beauty of the story Dan just shared and how it can feed into the broader system story. I loved that document that Dan had, and it was much more straightforward than the one that we have captured through the years from different places. But the beauty of the system is that he let us then use it to share. And I think I've probably given it to at least 10 other foundations in our 82 foundation family, because Dan was nice enough to share it. So we're working to find what he described, this balance of you've got to keep it local. We know that boards have to engage at the local level. But why do we have to not still share broadly? And that has been a well-shared commitment statement, because it's so well done.
You know, I knew I should have copyrighted that. David, I do want to mention one other thing that I forgot to mention. One of the things that during that initial meeting that is a verbal comment, I don't put this in the statement of commitment. It could be added, but, and this is something that Nancy and I have talked about in the past, is that verbally it's emphasized at that very first meeting with a prospective board member that we expect board members to make this charity, this foundation,
their priority,
your number. Well, the way we phrase it is to make it one of your top two. And the reason we say that is that for a lot of people, faith organizations might be their priority, or perhaps their alma mater.
Sure.
And we say, as long as it's one of your top two philanthropic priorities. What I noticed is so many board members were like, oh, I sit on this board and that board and this board. And they had this reputation amongst others in the community and others on the board that, oh, we got Tom Smith on our board. He's also on all these big boards across town. And I said, I don't think that's a good thing. I think that's not a great thing. They can be a donor, but to be a board member, and it's emphasized in that initial meeting, you're elevating yourself from a friend of the hospital, a donor of the hospital, a member of a committee, whatever, to serving on the board, then this means you should treat this as one of your top two, if not your top, to your point, David, philanthropic priority.
No, I appreciate that. And you've turned the tables and you're providing me with some therapy in that I can say completely every study, feasibility study, assessment of a foundation, when we're out there and we're doing interviews and talking to folks that we hope have some sort of a buy-in with that organization, the majority, and I don't want to pin an exact percentage, but close to 50% will say, oh, well, I'm just on the board because Nancy or Dan asked me. I really care about name the charity of choice, but it's not the charity that they're on the board for. And so to see that you're very transparent and you're putting this out there and it's the expectation, it's going to go a long way. And obviously you're going to reap benefits from that. So, you know, congratulations on that. And I will be using your advice.
The other area, David, that I think we've seen progress, but not as much as we want to see. And I'm wondering if you have this experience with some of the other foundations that you work with. We, as I think philanthropy leaders, we always care a lot about relationships, but sometimes that means we're afraid to let anyone go off the board. And so we've started working with our foundations to say, once you've started to create the more transparent purpose of the foundation to the board members, and they understand what the role is, it's okay if they self-select off. We shouldn't be trying to hang on to those board directors that really aren't a good match. But that really was an aha moment, I think, for some of our chief philanthropy officers, because we were so well trained to say, never let a friend go away.
No, I am excited. I am absolutely thrilled when in the midst or prepping for a campaign, the chief philanthropy officer calls and says, you know, Mr. and Mrs. X are going to step off because you scared them. And you said that they have to be committed to this campaign and that, you know, they need to support it with their time and their talent. I chuckle and I'm thrilled because they're probably wonderful people, but this isn't, we need kind of linemen. We need people blocking and tackling and pushing us downfield. And it's absolutely, absolutely okay. I can't, Board Source put this out years ago, but there was a kind of a survey, what's the right size board even for fundraising? And it wasn't 24, it wasn't 25, it was like 6-7 people. And if you have the 6 or 7 right people, well, everything else falls into place. So I think there's this expectation that you have to stack the board, you have to fill all the seats, everybody has to stay on forever. That's just not the case.
Yeah, and it's contagious on both sides. If people are engaged and involved, you get 2 or 3 or 4 and they all start going, or you get 2 or 3 that won't do it, and that creates that deafening silence we've all had in some board meetings where they're not engaged. Sure. So it's a great thing if the wrong people just self-select and say, I'll help in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Means you're doing the right thing. You're doing a good job. So some great tips on keeping board members engaged. One last question that I'd like to kind of put to the two of you is, how are you finding board members? That's a challenge for not-for-profits across all sectors, whether it's healthcare, education, social service, that everybody wants those amazing board members, and it's almost a competition to see who can get to them first. what are you doing, I guess, as a system, and then as an individual localized foundations to recruit the best talent?
Well, I'll go ahead and start, as you, and then you can give us some real examples, Dan. I think I almost will start with what we're not doing. What I'm encouraging people to not do anymore is to think board recruitment is take my buddy to lunch and say, hey, join the board. And to have a step back a little and have a much more strategic approach to board development, knowing that it's a longer term kind of initiative you're driving that does kind of an assessment of where you're at, what are your gaps, and then how are you going to start filling them. We're really, really, we care very much about creating boards that are reflective of the community. And so we really look at the diversity on our board, the gender, the different industries. And you can't do that if you just take your buddy to lunch. And so to really kind of take a step back and say, what do we look like now? I've always enjoyed working with some of our foundations to say, let's look at your board. And once you create the pie charts of where you're at on each, you see the glaring gaps. And that immediately changes the perspectives and asks the CPOs to start thinking about, okay, I need to think about this a little bit differently and start seeing where I would have greater impact if I focused on filling these gaps. Okay. I do like a committee. I like the board to have some version of a committee or task force where they again are leading it, so that it's not poor Dan that has to go out and recruit every single one of his board directors. And more engagement, and again, partnering that, as he said, with a really clear sense of commitment to what it is they're coming on board to do with you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, a couple things came to mind talking about that, David. I think back to, I used to work in higher education fundraising, and I'm sure you're familiar with CASE.
Absolutely.
And to this day, I couldn't tell you what CASE stands for, because to me, it's always copy and steal everything. So
it still is.
with copy and steal everything, there was a great, one of the best board members that I came across was when I worked in Pittsburgh. And this gentleman created this diversity skills matrix that I referenced earlier that I continue to use today. And it's a very simple Excel spreadsheet. Again, it's something I'd be thrilled to share with anyone, and I often share it. And I know Nancy just talked about having that ability to have some sort of matrix that allows the committee of the board, whether it's a governance committee or the executive committee, that can take that combination of, you know, someone bringing a name forward and then sort of putting it to the test with the matrix, at least initially.
Okay.
And so the matrix is simply a listing of the current board members, at least the matrix we use. And then it just goes across, you know, how many men and women do you have on the board? Then they go through sort of ethnic makeup of the board. Then you go geography. A lot of people forget about geography, but when you think about a community hospital, a word we use a lot is what's our service area.
Sure.
And so, you know, San Bernardino might be where one of my hospitals is, but it also serves parts of Fontana or Lake Arrowhead. And then Glendale might serve parts of Los Feliz or even into Burbank. So then you begin to say, well, do we have board members that represent those communities? Because if we don't, that's a lack and a hole where we could be tapping some potential board members and donors for that matter. So then you go on and then you look at the professional. You know, sure, you could list every major profession you can think of, or you could be strategic and say, what professions could bring us value? Do we have someone in marketing? Do we have someone in legal background? Do we have someone medical background, retired physician, blah, blah, blah. Then, of course, we better have a whole column about fundraising. Do we have someone who is experienced with campaigns? Do we have someone experienced in planned giving, estate planning? So, and on and on, even event planning, you know. But another story came to mind, and that is one of the things that we talk a lot about with our board members is the elevator speech. And I know that's a popular topic. It's come up throughout my career, and quite often we went in a whole different angle. I'm like Mr. Simple. You know, we talked about the statement of commitment and the diversity skills matrix. It's like, keep it simple. So our elevator speech is super simple, and it's so yes, we try to keep up with what are the priorities of the hospital. And certainly if you're in a campaign, it's very easy, you know, hey, we're renovating the ED. I mean, that people can, we're building a new tower or, you know, whatever. Yes, okay. But we can't expect board members to be able to rattle off the top of their head the priorities of the hospital. We just can't. We can try to share it with them, but the reality is, you know, 24 hours later, they're going to be like, I remember one of them. And then it'll get, you know, whatever. So this is how simple I took it. I said, okay, and we haven't even gotten into this on this call yet about the importance of shifting your board to thinking about major gift fundraising, which I hope we do. But with that, what I said to them is, think about it as relationship building. And I know this is Nancy's expertise, but I said, you know, when you meet with someone that's in your circle, let's just pretend you're at a cookout or you're at a work gathering or an association meeting of whatever you do. And someone says, oh, hey, Dan, what's going on? What are you going to say? What are the two things every single time? You talk about work or you talk about family. It's almost always that, unless you're doing something crazy on the side they know about, like, you know, you're in a rock band or something and they reference it. It's always family and it's always work. What I said to the board is, here's what I want you to do. If this person that comes into your circle that I want you to begin to think about, or these people who have the capacity, you know, they have the capacity to invest in our mission. That's as far as I want you to take it. The next time you see them and they say, hey, what's going on, Mary? And Mary says, well, you know, family's good, got a couple daughters in college and yeah, work. Oh, it's crazy right now, so busy. And add one more thing. That's all I'm asking. Say, and I'm serving on this hospital foundation board and I'm really loving it. I go, don't even say anything else. Just stop there and let and see if they bite. Well, what's that about? Oh, really? What hospital? Any question, you know, particularly now, they're going to ask, you know, and so then they can get more information. And it's that notion of, so I know I took that to the level of board member, but that could be a way to turn in to find a new board member. If someone says, well, what do you like about it? Oh, we really talk about fundraising and buying new equipment and doing things in the community, and maybe you'd like to hear more about it. You know, then you begin to go, well, they know that that person has capacity. Now they've suddenly expressed some level of interest. The interest might be in the hospital. The interest might be in healthcare, or the interest might be in their role on the board. So let's dive a little deeper as time goes by. But I just want to get that little story out there. That's something that resonated with my board that didn't scare them off.
No, I think it's a great point, and one that I try to make, and I'm glad that you're making, is that we overcomplicate what we do. And sometimes that, oh, let's have 25 different committees and the elevator speeches, you know, it's War and Peace. It's not an elevator speech, and nobody buys into it. But if we keep it simple, this is our mission, this is what we're trying to do, you're going to have success. You made an interesting point, and I did want to transition into that. So we've been talking about board members. We know that that recruitment is probably, from a fundraising perspective, the most important fundraising committee, or pretty close to it, as far as success, right? Who's going to nominate those board members? How are we going to get those board members involved? So they're on. They're involved in XYZ Foundation. What are you all doing from either a system perspective or, again, from the local perspective to transition them from saying, oh, let me buy a table at the gala, or I'll buy a foursome in the golf tournament, which we want them to do, absolutely, because it's fun and it creates awareness to, I want to introduce you to my roommate from college who just sold his tech company for $5 billion, and he's going to care about what you're doing. Love to hear that.
Go ahead, Nancy.
Well, I mean, I know Dan's going to have some great, really hands-on examples because I've seen him in action with that. But I do think it comes back to education, right? When we get the right board people, right board members around the table, helping them to start understand what real fundraising looks like, moving away from the, you know, bake sale mentality, or their only involvement is on the one big special event, which we know has cost to raise a dollar, which is, you know, makes you question unless it's delivering pipeline, right? Unless it's really delivering great pipeline opportunities, and helping them to have the data and the understanding of what it takes. There was another good study that was done a while back that looked at what should you have your board ideally spend their time on? And it looked first at what do they spend their time on? It was by the Healthcare Fundraising Board 2020. I know we all remember that one. But it looked at what do they spend their time on now? Only 20% of it was fundraising. And then they talked about ideally we wanted to flip it to be 80% fundraising. But then we talked, what do we mean by fundraising? So we don't scare them away. It's not that we expect you to go out and ask every person you know to write a big check, but it's to open the door to those people like you just described, the guy who just started his, you know, a new billion-dollar kind of company. Open the door and create those relationships, because we're going to make so much more progress on our fundraising with that kind of handoff and role as an ambassador than we are by having another event, another golf tournament, another.
And people are surprised when you talk to them and say, you can be involved in philanthropy and fundraising without making the ask. Everybody thinks that that is the only thing that they can do.
Mm-hmm. So, all right. Good. Yeah. So I go education.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Nancy shared that pie chart. And when I talked about what resonated with my boards, and again, at both the foundations that I work with, this notion of 80-20 came up in two different ways. So I'll talk about first the one that Nancy mentioned, and that was that simple pie chart in that white paper, the Board of 2020, which they probably want to rename it now. But at any rate, you know, it went from that 20% was going towards governance, 20% towards finance, 20% special. I mean, it's typical of what you're describing, David, with the typical board. And that on the right was, well, what you really want the Board of 2020 to look like in the future board is, as Nancy said, 80% focused on fundraising and cultivation. So major gift, basically relationship building, as we talked about, and then 20% governance. There was nothing else on that pie chart. And so that really resonated with the board. And that's what led us to really focus in on how do we get to that 80-20. That being said, the very first thing when I went to both boards, I put up a quote. And the quote was from a guy named Jerry Panis, which maybe you knew, David. He's since passed away.
Sure.
Fundraising guru.
Absolutely.
One of his final interviews I was reading, it was a couple years ago. And this quote, I took a snippet from it that I put up to the board. And it said, at the time, he said, about 10 years ago, so that was more the early 2000s, there was the 80-20 rule. And the 80-20 rules is that you're getting 80% of your support from 20% of your constituency. And particularly with, you know, a campaign, I think he was particularly talking about campaigns. But he said today, and again, we're talking a few years ago, he said it's more like 95-5 now.
It's even higher now.
It's even higher.
It's like 98, 97.
And we talked to the board about that. And it was almost like seeing that and then the 80-20 board chart, so many light bulbs went off to where it was like, oh, you know, maybe, you know, doing the direct mail and trying to get everybody to give you $100. And if everybody just gave that's in your list, then everyone would be fine. And it's like, it's changed. Not only would it probably never work that way, but let's just assume it did one day. You know, nowadays it's becoming more, like you said, 96, 97, maybe even 98%.
So I can share this with you that we're seeing it in Europe and we're seeing it here in the States, that campaigns, regardless if they're a $1 billion campaign or the $1 million campaign or a $500,000 campaign, it's between 60 and 100 donors. they make or break your campaign, regardless of size. So that point of transferring the board member's role to philanthropy, if you don't do it, you're gonna hit a wall. You're not gonna succeed from a campaign perspective. So the good thing is campaigns are much faster now, right? If I started in higher ed, you were in higher ed, they used to be slots, right? They were 5-year initiatives. And by year four, everybody was burnt and 24 months, maybe 36 months, depending, and that's even pushing it now. So this whole kind of shift is amazing. But what you're trying to accomplish of moving boards to philanthropy and major gifts, it's the only way you're going to succeed moving forward in a campaign setting. And I know that's not the topic today, but that's the end result, right? That's the end goal. We want to succeed in our campaigns, whether they're annual or comprehensive or endowment.
Yeah, I will say one of the things Nancy and I talked about that I've implemented at our boards, and this leads to my need help from the philanthropist. It's hard to say that.
It's a ton to it. That's the whole point.
That's right. I no one forgets it. Is when we made the switch, and again, it was basically a presentation and we did a variety of things. I won't go into every detail, but at every quarterly board meeting, our board chair has every single board member do round table. Okay. So during committee report, we go around and the board member says, okay, it's time for round table. I'll begin. And what round table is as a part of our statement of commitment, every board member is now expected to have at least one prospect a year. And in some cases, prospects carry over. We all know that because it takes sometimes longer to cultivate someone to a major gift, but at least one. And they are to report on that prospect at every single board meeting. And part of that is, like our board chair, one of our board chairs, I swear he has 14. So he's great, and maybe at the board meeting, he only reports on 2 or 3. And then we have other board members who might say, I initially gave the name to you, Dan, you take it from here, you can use my name, and then I would report, I would let them know the status. And then at the board meeting, they would still report. And okay. The reason why that's important is it's that peer pressure as they go around the room, and it just keeps re-emphasizing at every board meeting that this board is all about fundraising, relationship building, cultivating. That is absolutely what this board is about. If you want to be on the hospital board, that's a different board. And mm-hmm. And so I think this notion of roundtable is something that we've implemented. So, Mr. Philanthropist, my challenge has been, it worked really well in the in-person meetings, because just think about it, going around the room. And we've been able to, we've been slowed down, like I said, with cultivation of new prospects, but we'll get back to it. I'm not as worried about that. It's more because the pandemic has extended way longer than anyone thought, that we're still doing these Zoom meetings, and it's a little harder without getting, that annoying feedback noise and everything.
Oh, I know.
Do the round table and be accountable that way. So I guess I'm asking you any tips on how we could continue that momentum in this virtual world.
Well, I love the peer pressure piece, right? Because that's just, I don't think we use it enough in a good way, right? That's not very, I don't mean to sound kind of sly on that. Have you considered kind of almost scrolling? So when you're up doing the Zoom, whether it's a side breakout that here's David Garamella and here's his prospect, and it's just a constant scroll, and here's Nancy and her prospect. So, Phil is missing and has no prospect. It was just something that kind of came quickly to my mind with that. The other thing you can look at is engaging one of your volunteers that's doing it, to put the pressure on the other board member if they're willing to, you know, pick up, you know, that peer-to-peer, right? We know peer-to-peer fundraising works best. So that peer-to-peer, come on, Dan, get back on the horse and find us the prospect would probably be the best solution. But yeah, I love that question.
That's a great suggestion. I the first one was when you talked about show the, I was less excited about the show on the list who isn't performing. And I was more excited about where you said, have someone who is almost like take, since we can't do round table really, I mean, we could.
Well, that's it, right?
Do a highlight of one that's working from that board member, and then follow up maybe afterwards individually and say, well, you heard that Mary Smith board member has really progressed with her prospect. How are you doing with Tom Jones that you're, you know, whatever.
And you're out of it too. So there's, I think it takes away some of that embarrassment. And yes. A lot of time, at least that's how I've seen volunteers that are really anxious and excited to help. And for whatever reason, you come to the meeting and, oh, I didn't make my calls, or I forgot to send my pledge payment in, or sign my pledge form. It's not that they don't care about you. They forgot. So that call from the peer, I think, would be amazing. I will tell you, though, I know that it's kind of hokey and silly, the listing of the names, but I can't take credit for this. Like we said earlier, copy and steal everything, right? But I've had two campaigns over the past maybe 5 or 6 years where the board chair, before any campaign meeting or board meeting, has a list, and these are two separate hospitals, no connection, would have a list of their board or kind of insiders gifts listed, or not necessarily the dollar amount, but that Dan Murphy made a gift and Nancy made a gift. And within a couple of board meetings, a couple of cycles, it was 100% participation, because it did create a little bit of a buzz. Anyway, just a different take to different things. But I hopefully that'll help, and you can get your board involved in the peer-to-peer kind of pressure.
Mm-hmm. One thing we've tried with a couple boards over the last 6 months during COVID, and it does depend on the depth of staff members you have, but we find that if we just do kind of the equivalent of prospect review with our board, if we just do it at the board meetings,
right,
then it sometimes doesn't have as much progress. And so we took with a couple of boards recently, we took their relationship map and we had every single person with them assigned at least to one or two or three of the development directors or the development person, with the goal of saying there between each meeting would be at least one substantive check-in with a development team member and them. Because right. The prod halfway along, that little nudge, sometimes is what makes them come to the next board meeting with a little more to tell,
sure.
Right?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. So
you got to balance that with the labor demand on your team, because, you know, our whole goal with engaging the board is to make sure that they really are doing some of this with us. But well, the other one thing I wanted to add, David, that that kind of was triggered when Dan was talking. One piece of, some of our board directors are really motivated by stories that they can tell, others more by data, right?
Right.
One study that I have found every single board that we've shared this with has gone, oh my gosh, is the one that was done by the advisory board that shows that when your board is working at
top
level, it doesn't matter. You can do the best special events, you can do grateful patient programs, you can do annual giving. All of that combined doesn't add up to the number of referrals that a high performing board.
That is such a powerful statistic. And I love to share it. And I love when people embrace it, because
mm-hmm. that's it. That's why they matter. They matter as much as a whole absolutely. 500 people at an event matter.
Mm-hmm. Although I'll be honest, I kind of look forward to the next time I can put my tux on and shave this beard and get out and like feel, you know, feel like a normal person again.
It was my comeback in fashion for different reasons here after this is all over.
I'm so ready. All right. Well, I am so very, very appreciative of the two of you. And just as a thank you, we would, at the Giving Collaborative, we'd like to make a small gift to a charity of your choice. So if you could let, just send me a note if there's something there, we'd love to do that in your honor, because we appreciate your friendship and your advice and your support. And we've learned so much from the two of you. And with that, is there any last kind of words of wisdom to our therapy? I got to think of a fun term.
Yeah, I love followers.
I have one final quote that I left my boards with after these initial meetings about, you know, changing the way they operate. But you referenced this earlier, but it's from another fundraising guy. He's Bill. His name is Bill Littlejohn. He's down at Sharp in San Diego. And he was speaking at a group I was at, and he said, fundraising isn't complicated, only the organization we support. I said, that is the perfect statement. Let's not complicate fundraising, because the health system is complicated enough.
Absolutely.
And leave that to the health system to worry about. So
100%.
Thank you, David.
No, thank you,
David.
This was amazing. I look forward to seeing you both in person very soon.
Yeah, good to see you both.
Waiting for those days. Thanks.